This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about growing up as a factor in mental health. It's a theme that we have covered before with previous host of the podcast, Annie Harris, but I'm really delighted to be revisiting it. If you do want to hear a little bit more background into mine and Annie's experience of growing up with mental illness, do check out that one in the back catalogue. But for today, we'll be talking to Flo Sharman. She's a campaigner with the charity MQ, a speaker, and just generally a mental health advocate who I'm really delighted to have got to meet and interview. Today, for the intro, we're a little bit different because Danielle isn't here. She's sadly off ill with a chest infection, but she will be back as usual next week. Also, next week will be the first intro we record since the live show in London, so we'll be able to talk all about how that went. For now, though, I've got a friend of mine and a friend of the podcast, Katie, here to do the intro with me. So we'll get into the stats and Katie can share her thoughts on them in Danielle's place. So for stats to do with growing up as a factor in mental health. So first off, from the Mental Health Foundation, they found that 20% of adolescents experience a mental health problem in any given year.
I think that the stat in real life is probably higher than that due to the fact that as a child, I know I didn't recognise myself as having depression that I've recently had diagnosed years and years on. I went to the GP, had some time off school, did an exam on my own, and then just carried on like nothing had happened. So I think that even still years on, people don't talk about it and you don't know how to recognise it as a child because we're not educated enough.
Right. I think that's a lot of people's experience, and we actually touched on something similar with a previous guest, Elise, a few weeks ago, who shared that that happened to her. So, you know, as much as the stigma is getting lighter and as much as the understanding is getting better, there's still a long way to go in schools. She had something similar where it was kind of ignored and not much was done.
Okay.
And then suddenly all the help kind of rushed in at once when she got really bad.
Yeah, and if you'd been gradually over 10 years, say, for example, you wouldn't feel so overwhelmed that she obviously felt at the time.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, of course, a big reason why we campaign for mental health education through the podcast, to try and get that early intervention, to give kids the tools to speak up when they need help and even just have the language to communicate how they're feeling.
And so that other people around them can recognise it too, because it's not just about picking it up yourself, it's about spotting the signs in other people.
For sure. And I really like that stat because it's quite similar to the one from Mind. One in four adults experience a mental health problem each year. And with that being 20%, that's one in five. So whilst I agree, the reality is probably higher.
Mm.
It just may be that a lot of kids aren't getting the support or the recognition that they're struggling. At the same time, it is interesting to kind of contrast that and see it's actually really near the adult rate that we often hear. And that's why it's so important that we don't ignore mental illness in young people. It does exist. In fact, also from the Mental Health Foundation, they found that 50% of mental health problems are established by the age of 14 and 75% by the age of 24.
I think that's because we're going into the highly pressured GCSE stage, and then if you choose to go to university, it's one of the most pressurised times of your life, very stressful. And often you don't really know in between the age of kind of 21, 22 to 25 where your life's going to go. And you're at that stage where you're trying to work out.
Yeah, no, that's true. And with that stat, they will have structured it in a way to emphasise the problem, to show the ages at which this prevalence is rapidly increasing. So to see that they've mentioned 50% by age 14, a time when most kids have moved school. They've moved certainly to senior school, but they may have moved to an entirely different school. And then the next marker they've put is 24, when people are coming out of university or getting into the job market by that stage. I think you're quite right. They're real change periods in people's lives. And that's why the recognition needs to be there that these mental health problems can start so young and should therefore get the support young. And I think you'll hear that as well with Flo's experience in the interview, that she had her first bout of severe mental illness quite suddenly, around the age of 8. Started from a really young age, but came on quite rapidly then.
Interesting.
So yeah, I'm really delighted to have shared her experience, not only in terms of talking through how young symptoms and mental illnesses can develop in people, which I think is something we've not delved into that frequently on the podcast, but also she'll talk a little bit about what it's like living with several mental illnesses. It's a really fascinating interview. She talks quite fast. There's just so much information she packs in, and I think a lot of that is from the campaigning work she does. She's used to having to kind of pack in as much insight as she can with the time that she gets.
And to get a message across.
Yeah.
From her own personal experiences.
Absolutely. So really delighted to have interviewed her. Like really any of the MQ campaigners, she's really brilliant and really articulate. So that's everything we have to say about the stats. Thank you so much, Katie, for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
Not leaving me to do an intro all by myself.
Why would I do that? It's with my friend.
So we'll get into the episode with Flo Sharman in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Liv Sharman and I'm a mental health campaigner and MQ ambassador, and my mental health journey, which I now know is a lifelong mental health journey, started when I was just 8 years old. My life changed drastically one evening. I was a happy-go-lucky young eight-year-old girl who loved school and adored my friends, and one evening my life just changed in an instant. I woke up in the middle of the night, confused, hallucinating, blind, my lip had dropped, I couldn't talk, I was paralysed throughout my whole left-hand side of my body, I was nauseous, and I had a horrific headache. It was the most terrifying ordeal, more so for my mother than it was for me, because I didn't really know what was going on. I was rushed into hospital with what they thought at the time was a bleed on the brain or a brain infection. But after numerous amounts of tests and many doctors swarming over me, doing all these different tests, they really didn't have any idea of what was going on. And they said, Flo, it's just a fluke-like attack and will never happen again. But they were so wrong.
Wow. So thank you for sharing that. I'm really glad to have you on the podcast and to share an experience like that, because so often that side of it is overlooked, the physical side of mental illness, in our perhaps drive to understand the disparity between how mental health and physical health are treated. It can be easy to like really force separation. So often on the show we'll talk about panic attacks as, you know, the physical side coming through, but with what you'd experienced, I can see why the doctors straight away saw it as physical. Because that's how you were presenting. You, of course, at that age had no idea what was going on. You'd gone through nothing similar. I guess the one bit of consolation is it's so rare for it to be that extreme, a physical reaction to breakdown. Do you remember at all at the time what you thought was happening to you?
I had no idea at all. It's really weird because I remember the evening so vividly, but also it's a complete blur at the same time. I had no idea. And to be honest, it wasn't till about 4 weeks after the attack that I kind of knew that I was in a mental breakdown and my life had changed instantly. It took quite a lot of time to kind of understand what was going on. And even, you know, my parents and the doctors, because for a while they thought it was physical illness, either epilepsy or other things. So it did take a while to understand that it was a severe mental breakdown.
Right, I can totally imagine. And what sort of things changed initially?
So basically, I became completely housebound, and I was actually housebound for nearly 18 months. I was excluded from my primary school because they were ashamed and embarrassed to have a pupil with mental illness at their school. And they didn't know how to deal with someone in a mental health crisis. So basically they thought, get rid of her. We don't need her in our school. We can get a pupil that's going to have much better grades and doesn't have mental illness. And I was in such a bad way that I was nearly sectioned at Tier 4 clinic, which my incredible mother fought for this not to happen, and I'm beyond grateful she did. It's been hard, you know, it's not been easy at all, and there's been so many struggles to get to where I am today.
Yeah, and that's particularly so sad what you've said about your school. Before recording, you'd mentioned that the school said you were scaring the other pupils. I guess it's one of those things you'll never truly know the decision making behind that, but just to hear that decision had been made, that they were so ill prepared and probably so ignorant of mental illness that denying education to a child, the complete opposite of what a school is there for, seemed to be the answer.
Yeah, and that is the real reason why I became a mental health campaigner, because I didn't want other children to lose their childhood because of their mental illness. I lost 10 years of my childhood because of my mental health issues, because I was labelled with depression, panic attacks, OCD and depression. When you're given those labels, nobody wants to know about you. They don't want to give you, you know, the education you need. I didn't have any friends. I didn't live like a normal 8-year-old. So I was having a mental breakdown, had no friends whatsoever, had been given all these labels, which at the time I kind of associated with not normal people. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to school like anybody else my age. So it made it 10 times worse. And no child, no matter what circumstances, should lose their childhood because of their mental illness.
Right, absolutely. Because you were already in such a horribly difficult situation. But the way you describe it is that actually the thing that was worse was the stigma, the reaction to your diagnoses as opposed to the symptoms and the diagnoses themselves.
Definitely. You know, it saddens me now to say it, but it took me to the age of 18 to not be ashamed and embarrassed about having mental health issues. I basically was so scared and embarrassed. I wouldn't even let any of my family or friends talk about mental illness when I was in their company because I was so ashamed by it. And it's all down to the stigma, and it has to stop.
Mm. And do you mind sharing what that shame felt like?
It was horrible. Even my sister at the time, you know, she hated having a sister who had mental health issues. And that's because she didn't have any understanding of what mental health was. And the understanding she had of it was that people with mental illness weren't normal people. And you know, when you're given these labels, you get put in a box and you think, oh, no, don't go near them. They're not normal. They've got all these problems. And it was absolutely horrible. And I remember all my friends that I had at primary school literally disowned me. I remember the day that my mum was brought into school and the headmistress brought us in and she said, you've got to leave. And I remember my mum saying to one of my friends, this is our number, please stay in touch. And she didn't. It's so sad that that happened, and I wish it hadn't. And I just, what upsets me more is that children these days don't have an understanding of mental health issues. And that is why it's so important that at an early age, they get that full understanding of what mental health is and how people suffering with it need your assistance and help and guidance.
Right, and how ultimately affects all of us. One of the most terrifying things I ever see is this kind of like contagious idea that some people have, and they can't even see it. And I've seen it where sometimes people will share experiences of mental illness and people have a physical reaction and draw themselves away from it. Not only is that so sad to see that people are treated that way, but also that people have so little understanding that they're actively not connecting with something that realistically affects all of us.
It really does. You know, the statistic, 1 in 4 people experience mental illness, but the reality is we all have mental health, we all have physical health, and we need to look after our mental well-being as well as our physical well-being. And it's so important that that happens. You know, our mental health is just as important as our physical health.
Absolutely. And so for you, going through this from such a young age, not having any idea what happened to you, and then being housebound for all that time, do you mind sharing what happened in that time and how you gradually got out of it?
Yeah, so it was an incredibly tough 2 years, and my mother gave up her high-powered job to be full-time carer for me because it got to the point that I refused to let any family member leave our home because I was so terrified of their safety, what could happen to me, what could happen to them. And I was in an extremely bad way. And I found actually the other day a certificate, and I cannot believe that I got a certificate for this, but this just shows how bad I was. The certificate was for going on the motorway for one junction and not jumping out of the car. Now I drive my own car and it's unbelievable how far I've come, but that shows
literally how, drove here today.
Yeah, exactly. And it shows how bad I was, but it shows just how far I've come. And you know, there was times we used to go food shopping. Mummy would get the basket. We'd get 4 things in our basket, and I would literally have to sprint out of the shop, scream, have the biggest panic attack because I was so scared of what was happening around me. And now I love shopping and enjoy it, but it has not been easy. You know, it's not been, you know, people who saw me when I was at my worst stage and now see me now and they think, well, what happened? Like, how have you got here? Like, there must have been a special cure, magic medication or wonder therapy, but it wasn't any of those things. You know, it's been really difficult to get to where I am today. And I still suffer to this day. You know, I still have PTSD, I still have depression, I still have OCD, and I still have panic attacks. But in the 2 years that I was housebound, basically it was talking therapy and doing yoga. And they were the 2 things that kind of helped me get out of the housebound state, really.
Right, because it sounds like there was just so much to unpick that through therapy that you'd ended up in a place that from such a young age you were overwhelmed by everything. You know, that's how it sounds. And so there was every single situation pretty much that involved leaving the house, you had to figure out a way to cope with.
You know, I was dealing with panic attacks, OCD. So literally I would lock the door about 25 times, checking that we weren't going to get locked in the house or that we were safe in the house. And as you say, literally the world was just crumbling. I was terrified of everything going on around me. And I remember the first time we went to go and have talking therapy, it took 8 visits for me to even step foot into the room that I had therapy. That's how bad I was. You know, it was terrifying. I even now, and actually today, it's been quite tough for me because Birmingham is where I had my therapy. And coming here, the PTSD, I still find it difficult now because that time in my life, getting to therapy was so difficult. And actually, therapy wasn't the thing that got me where I am today. I had CBT on probably 8 occasions and it didn't work for me. But for others, it works wonders. But that's the thing, we are all individuals and we need to be treated individually. But unfortunately, society don't see that. They think, we'll give you those labels and you'll have that medication and we'll do that therapy and you'll be great. Just like, you know, the other 4 people that we've seen before you. But that's not the case. We are all individuals and have to be treated individually.
For sure. And that's strange in a way that so often it's overlooked, because with physical health, whilst often there are less complications, you know, there's certain physical conditions where you just have one medication and that's it. Like, that's the only option the doctors have. But even within that, the other factors are so often acknowledged. You know, the exercise as a positive factor in just our general physical health has always been acknowledged. And yet it's taken so much work for it to be acknowledged with mental health.
It's really
quite baffling.
Yeah. And, you know, I am very grateful that my mother, you know, my mother's very feisty. And I think that's where I get my feistiness from. And she was like, we're going to get a plan in place of what's going to help me get out of this housebound state. And we found an amazing yoga teacher, and walking the dogs was the best therapy for me. And I say it wasn't therapy for me, but as you say, you know, there isn't one medication fits everyone. It's not the case at all. You can have depression, you can be labeled with depression, but I will deal with depression very differently from someone else. Everybody's mental illness is individual to them, and their treatment plan should be individual to them. And exercise, for me, has been my saviour.
Mm.
I honestly can say now, I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for exercise. And I'm so grateful for my parents being so sporty that they always said that exercise would help me, and it really has.
It's incredible. And it's something that I can really relate to. I walk a lot. And, you know, that's something that I've always done. You know, I was brought up that we go on like walking holidays and stuff as a family. And I think I'm at a point where it's just so ingrained that I was saying earlier to Danielle that if I've like had a pretty inactive day and then I go post a letter, I'll just end up subconsciously taking the long way back, just because it's just so ingrained as the way that I cope and feel, I guess, partly productive. And then I was speaking to my counsellor recently and I said, you know, why is it that, you know, I'll go for a walk and the thing that's been like bugging me all day long, then I go for a walk and that's when I get the answer for it. Like, surely the exercise can't kick in that, you know, I wasn't even trying to make a point. I was just rambling at her a little bit. I was like, the exercise can't kick in that quickly. And she said, but the endorphins can. I was like, oh yeah.
People don't realize how powerful exercise is. And like, even just going outside for 10 minutes and going for a walk, it can help you so much. It's like at my office, they all joke at me because I go, whatever the weather, I go out for 20 minutes on my lunch break on a walk, and it just makes me feel so much better. And a bit like you, you know, we've always been an active family, or we've always had dogs, we've always done dog walking, and I'm really grateful for that because it's really helped me in my recovery. And there isn't a day go by that I don't do some form of exercise. And my mum, it's unbelievable, she can notice. She goes, if I've not done exercise for say 2 days, she'll be like, Flo, you need to do exercise because your mental health is going downhill. And I can notice it myself. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's the most powerful thing, but it costs nothing. You know, you can go walking or running outside and it doesn't need to cost anything. And it is, people don't realize how beneficial it is for your mental health. You know, it's brilliant for your physical health, but it helps your mental health so much.
Right. And I mean, even just that anecdote is such a good example of the physical mental separation, that even as much as I'm trying not to do that and trying to see all the links, I still missed a really obvious one.
Mm.
So no, it is so transformational. Also, side note, you can listen to podcasts whilst walking.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's brilliant. And you know, I going on long walks and with the dogs, for 2 years I was housebound, that's all I could do. And even if it was for 30 minutes, it was my time where literally I was running away and I wasn't crippled with my depression or panic attacks and OCD and depression. You know, it was just my 30 minutes of free time. I could just be myself and just forget about everything that was going on around me, and it really helps me, and even to this day it does now. I love it.
Right. And I think also there's a strange kind of control in it, that you're taking charge of your body and what's happening. I used to do it all the time when I worked in a more corporate background, and I would just get to the lunch break and I would just need to get out of the building. I've been in one room for like 5 hours working as hard as I can. I'm like, now I just need to walk in any direction.
Yeah, I can't. I used to work in eventing, so I was outside all the time, and then went to an office job about 3 years ago. And I find it really difficult being, you know, sitting still for 4 hours or so. So I get up all the time and go and walk. And it's amazing. Like, you just think, it's crazy to think, just getting up, going for a little walk, how much it can help your mental health and, like, be so beneficial. And it's the tiniest thing, really, in your day, but it helps so much. And I think, as you say, on the controlling side, I have to be quite careful with my exercise. Because of my OCD, I can get quite obsessive over it and do too much exercise, so I have to be really careful. But it is a great way because you can manage it and do whatever you want to do, say going for long walks or running or yoga or HIIT. There are so many different ways to get in exercise and how much it can help your mental well-being as well as your physical well-being. So you've got, you know, you're helping your physical well-being and you're helping your mental well-being. What more could you want, really?
Absolutely. But that's really great to hear how much that positively impacted you. Did you have other options offered to you? Was like medication given as an option?
So yeah, I have been on medication for 12 and a half years and I probably will be on medication for the rest of my life. And we joke about it now, actually. And we had a joke about it over the weekend with my parents and they were like, I was taking my medication, which I do every morning and have done for 12 and a half years. And at the beginning, I was so embarrassed to take medication for my mental health. But it is no different from taking medication for your physical health. You know, is there a taboo about taking medication for your asthma? No. So why is there such a taboo about it, taking medication for your mental health? And the reality is, I didn't really know what I'd be like not on medication, but it's not been the main driver that's helped me get to where I am today.
Right. So do you feel like that kind of helps with your stability, whereas other factors help with your kind of growth and recovery?
Definitely. I think I always say that kind of medication is the starting block and then everything else is the big building block that helps me. You know, exercise outdoors and my animals are kind of my key medicines, really. But the medication, yeah, I'd be scared to come off it, really, because I don't know what I'd be like not on it.
Yeah, it is scary. Do you mind sharing what specifically it's prescribed for or what kind of effects those drugs are meant to have?
Okay, so basically I have it for my depression. It's an antidepressant, but also because of my physical illness, so the blindness and the numbness and paralyzation, I still get those symptoms. So it's also to help with that as well, because that's linked, but it is mainly an antidepressant.
And it is really interesting, that approach of like it being like the first step. I think that's a really good way of looking at it, because so often there can be this kind of debate between different approaches to mental health recovery, as if you're only allowed one. I don't know if maybe that's a like austerity thing from the news that's like bleeding into our psyche or what.
No, definitely. I think it's people think one medication, one therapy. No, you can have lots of different things. And I say that it's like my coping mechanism toolbox is built of so many different things to help me with my mental health. It's not just one thing.
Mm-hmm. So having come so far already, is there anything else you want to share about that journey of recovery?
So yeah, the journey has not been easy, and it's such a cliche to say this, but time has been a huge thing in my recovery. You know, it will be 14 years this year since the breakdown happened. And I've had a lot of relapses, you know, so I kind of came out of it when I was about 12 and then I had a relapse at 14. It was the moment that kind of clicked with me when I thought, I'm not going to get better from my mental illness. I'm not going to, you know, it's not going to be a cure. Unfortunately, there never is a cure for mental illness. But it was the time that I decided not to put pressure on myself to get so-called better. And that was the turning point for me in my recovery. And it was the time that I kind of said, you know, this is me. I have mental health. It's not going to just disappear like that. I need to be proud of it. I need to not be ashamed of it and just let myself heal and get better with all these different therapies and treatments and things that really helped me. But the journey has been really difficult. And there's been about 5 key moments that I've wanted to give up and not wanted to live. And, you know, I still to this day have suicidal thoughts, and you know, this just shows that mental illness will never go away. 4 weeks ago I had a really bad PTSD flare-up and very bad suicidal thoughts, and I was in a really bad way. But the difference from when I had my mental breakdown to now is I have those tools in place to get me out of that place, and I know I have the strength to get through it. But it's not easy. And you know, people say, do you wish you could change anything? And do you wish you didn't go through what you go through? And the quick answer is no, I don't wish I could change anything, because it's made me who I am today. But the thing I wish I could change is not putting pressure on myself so much to get so-called better and get rid of the mental illness, because that was never going to happen.
Right. That's a really interesting perspective, because we've covered recovery before. We did an episode all about it. And I hear a lot of different perspectives on to what extent you can recover. So do you mind sharing your perspective on that?
I know I'll always have it, but I think the difference from when I had that breakdown is panic attacks for me now don't happen very often. You know, they happen, I probably at the worst time was getting 3 major panic attacks a day. Now it's probably 4 a year. Depression, you know, I think a big thing for me is I understand it so much more than when it first happened. You know, I have a real understanding of depression, panic attacks, OCD and PTSD. And I know the telling signs to know when it's going to spiral out of control. I think that's the really key point. And knowing yourself, you know, knowing when you need to seek help and talk openly about it. I think talking for me has really helped me in my recovery. But I think recovery for everyone is completely different. You know, I'm kind of in recovery and think I will be in recovery for the rest of my life. I'll never fully recover, but I know how to deal with it much better than when I was diagnosed with it 12 years ago.
Right. I think that's very fair. One of the perspectives that's really helped me understand this is the idea that maybe it makes more sense if we attribute symptoms of mental illnesses, not so much to the mental illnesses, but the trauma that caused them, that then it starts to make more sense, this kind of ebbing and flowing of recovery. That if you've, for example, PTSD, you've gone through something that's caused that and caused all the symptoms that come along with it, well, you can manage those symptoms, but the trauma remains. And so there's always going to be that kind of risk of you falling back into the same symptoms that, to a degree, a reflection of you struggling to cope, but also sometimes can be a reflection of an unhealthy way of coping, and that may crop up again.
Definitely. I know now my triggers, and like today was quite a trigger for me for my PTSD, but I know how to deal with it. But I think the trauma, I mean, all my mental health issues all stem from having life-saving surgery as a young baby and stopping breathing over 50 times and my mother having to resuscitate me on my christening day. We only discovered that my mental breakdown and all my mental illnesses stemmed from that point 2 years ago, because the research hadn't been done of baby trauma and what it can cause later on in life. So for me, hospitals are a very big trigger point for me. And weirdly, corridors, you know, big, dark corridors, they remind me of hospital. And I didn't even remember being in hospital at 4 months old, having life-saving surgery and stopping breathing. But my brain does and is a big trigger for me. But yeah, I deal with it. But as you say, there are trigger points in recovery.
Right. Well, that's it. I guess you were picking up the symptoms even at that point, that you were struggling to cope as a child. You just don't necessarily remember all the things you were struggling to cope from. It is really fascinating to think that we can have symptoms from things we don't even remember. Like, that's something that initially it took me a while to wrap my head around. But of course, that's the case, because it's not like below a certain age, you have a certain amount of memories that are just lost, and therefore trauma doesn't affect you. Of course it doesn't work like that, but it is fascinating to hear you've gone through that process, and I'm not at all surprised it took a while to figure out how far back this all went.
Yeah, even now I know some of the environments I go into will be remind me of things that I haven't remembered before, but there'll be a trigger point. And I think it's really important to remember with trauma is when it happened, I was the happiest I'd ever been as a child. You know, I was loving life and really enjoying it. And it just happened like that. And you don't know when it's going to crop up. And the trauma just, like, so I had 4 months, I had my life-saving surgery. And then I basically had quite late development. But then I had like 6 years of nothing at all, you know, absolutely fine. And then bam, at 8 years old, my brain remembers it and it goes, that trauma, you know, you remember it and it's going to cause all these problems.
Wow. Yeah. How did you feel when you figured more of that out and you learned how far back this all went?
I find it quite difficult at the start, because I think, and this is why I became an MQ ambassador, because they're all about research.
Right.
And for me, it's so important that more research is done. And I truly believe that if more research hadn't been done, maybe my journey would have been very different, because when I had that life-saving surgery, the doctors could have warned my parents that the trauma at such a young age of stopping breathing could cause later on mental illnesses. Or when I had my mental breakdown, there was a much clearer picture of why this had happened, but we had no idea. It was like, why has this happened? We don't know. And I think research is so important. It's vital.
Right. Absolutely, because if you think of the level of trauma of that, it can be easy to write it off, it being such a young experience. But realistically, your small, vulnerable body essentially went through death multiple times. And so to think that that's not going to affect you, and even for the doctors to not communicate the likelihood of that is shocking. But like you say, research is the way forward.
It really is. It's so important. And, you know, I think my journey and whole story would have been very different if those doctors and consultants would have had better understanding of mental illness and the trigger points and the trauma of what could cause it. And yeah, I think it would have been a very different story, but I can't change what has happened to me. But what I can do is I can help fundraise for amazing research. And by sharing my story, I hope I can help others in my situation.
For sure. I'm confident you do every day. And so with that in mind, what kind of messages would you want to share to anyone that's relating to your story?
I think for me, and the biggest thing I've learned over the last few years, is that the power of being yourself is the best thing you can be. I have mental illnesses. I have 4, as you've heard, but I now know they don't define me. They're part of me. And what I say is they're part of my life jigsaw. But they're one very small part. They do not define you. And if you have mental health issues and you're suffering in silence, don't be ashamed to speak out and seek help, because it's not failure or weakness. It's the complete opposite. It's true bravery. And your mental illness does not define you. You know, I'm 21 years old now. I'm an MQ ambassador. I get to do these amazing things. I have a brilliant job. I have wonderful friends around me. And I'm my true self. And I think being you is the best thing you can be, mental health and all. And we shouldn't change for anybody, because ourselves are who we are. And that is the best thing you can be. You know, I just wish that it didn't take me till I was 18 to get to the point that I thought, no, I'm going to be my true self. I'm not going to be ashamed of having mental illnesses. It's made me who I am today. And for that, I'm incredibly proud.
Right. And it's a difficult journey, you know, and that's something that I've really had to work on in speaking out about mental health more, that you need to be authentic to who you are. Initially, pre-podcast, I think I felt I needed to be a certain type of ambassador, and I needed to share my story in a particular way for it to be valid or to be useful to people. But actually, through working on myself and then going on to create a show like this, I've realized how strangely relatable my experiences are. I didn't really think they were. And then I speak to so many wonderful guests like you and notice not the differences, but the parallels, that we're all out here trying to search for connection, and that people will be actively trying to connect with our stories. We just need to share them and be as open as we can be.
Definitely. And I just wish that I had learned, you know, I wish I had had someone say to me, be your true self, Flo, mental health and all, at such a young age, rather than bottling up, basically. I hid behind so many things. And I look back at pictures and I look the happiest little young girl, but inside I'm crumbling. And now I show my emotions, I'm my true self all the time. And it's really powerful. And when you're surrounded by people you can be open to, it's the best thing.
Absolutely. I love that. And from a personal note, I really find it the best antidote to rescue complex, because that's something I've got experience in, of wanting to rescue people, particularly those I relate to in terms of their stories and having similar experiences. I want to swoop in and protect them in the way that I wasn't always able to protect myself, you know, and in ways that looking back made my mental illnesses worse. But really the opposite to that, and the thing that I really work to do now, is to instead be the person I wished I had to look up to. So rather than going in and trying to save an individual person, just being the best version of me and owning my shit as much as I can and being an example of all that as humans we can overcome. And by doing that, that's how you really change lives. That's where people find empowerment. The people don't really need to be rescued. They need support in order to rescue themselves.
Completely agree. And I always say, you know, I was so lucky to have my mother as a listening ear. I just wish that more people would open up and have friends and family support them and know that they can talk openly about anything they want. And actually, what's really helped me, and I didn't think it would, but it's helped me so much, is by being my true self and sharing my story has helped my recovery and helped me be more open and talk openly about it. And it's, as you say, it's all about empowerment. And, you know, if I can get through a mental breakdown at the age of 8 years old, I can get through anything. And it shows you that you really can get through anything the world throws at you. And, you know, even in my bleakest moment, I knew there was a flicker of light that I could get through it, and I had the strength to get through it, no matter what.
Wow, that is such a great place to wrap up. Thank you for that. So if people want to learn more about you and your work with MQ, I love that that rhymes, where should they go?
So my Instagram handle is @ploshaman. And if you want to check out MQ, it's mqmentalhealth.org, and they're transforming mental health.
Brilliant. All right, so we'll finish up there. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.